Sacrifice is what makes a God great. Often it is the sacrifices that are made to them, but sometimes it is about what the gods themselves sacrifice. When Anansi, the god of knowledge and stories, decided to leave the place that would later be called Africa, it was not out of duty or necessity, but love. Not love for the dull black faces stuffed in the bottom of the big ships sailing across the even bigger water, even though love them he did in his own way, and as much as a god can love things that break so easily. He did not go for them, but for the stories they took with them, the stories that were dying on the ships and drowning in the vast emptiness of the never-ending water. You see, the stories belonged to him, and he wanted them back, even though he knew that crossing the water would change him. And so it was that Ba'anansi, the son of the earth herself, who had stolen the stories from the sky god Niamen and had brought rain to many dying fields, this same Anansi followed the path of blood left by the many ships. He took the stories from the dead and the dying before their shaved heads could sink to the bottom of the water. And when he reached the new place, he stopped being Ba'anansi, about whom even the first gods were careful. And he became Anansi the spider. He sacrificed so much of his power until all he had left were the stories he had traveled so far for. These are those stories, collected from sources both fictional and factual, but always reliable. My name is History, and what follows is a fantasy. A fantasy that is the product of my own research. A fantasy that could very well be a retelling of Forgotten Things. Chapter 1, Passage Through the Middle. For obvious reasons, there is very little written about Kamau the Obaifo before he arrived on the island. Obaifos are ageless, so we do have a clear picture of a towering man with muscles like iron and locks like a lion's mane. His eyes, when they did not burn with the terrifying white fire, were black, like water at midnight. Aside from his appearance, all we know is what was collected from the few who met him and lived. From these stories, we can imagine what things were like on the night that she was taken. Back then, it is said that Kamau was a rare thing, an Obaifo who could control the bloodlust. This he had done so he could live with Asa, the beautiful village witch. But even monsters in love are still monsters, and an Obaifo must feed. This is why he was too far away when he felt them take her, too far even for him to get back. Still, he ran like a cheetah, covered in the blood he had been draining from the lion carcass. We can imagine his locks trailing behind him as he made his desperate run, stopping only long enough for the burning in his chest to subside. It was 3 days before he reached the village, and they were long gone by then. Kamau might have breathed in the gunpowder and blood left behind by the raiders, the man inside him howling like the animal with which it shared his space. He may have went to the place where they lived, even though his nose would have already told him everything. He would have wanted to sit on their bed and feel some of her things in his hands, but the thieves would have destroyed it all. The pieces of her magic broken and scattered across the floor like the bodies of so many dead warriors. Everyone agrees that he tried to get to her, stop them before they reached the water. Like so many others, he knew what happened to people at the coast, especially the women. Kamau would have had to run, the two parts of him, usually at war, calling a desperate truce so they could reach Asa. An old Ghanaian tale tells of a bloody battle between an Obaifo and a Buddha, a half-man, half-hyena beast. The Obaifo left the Buddha bloody and broken, but did not stop to drain it, as was expected. Scholars now believe this story is about Kamau, who would have had to ignore ancient feuds and cross through the territories belonging to other creatures as he cut a straight line to the coast. It is here that we have the first documented sighting of the Obaifo. Maybe we should clarify for listeners who are not familiar with the more technical terms. Kamau was an immortal being who was strongest at night and fed off the blood and energy of living things. It would be a while still before writers and scholars of the occult playing catch-up in Europe would coin the term vampire. But Kamau was indeed a vampire. He had been old when that infamous Romanian count was just a boy. It is here that we have the first documented sighting of the Obaifo, or the vampire. The Dutch merchant Adrian Jansen was trading off the coast nearest to the village where most scholars believe Kamau and Asa hail from. He kept a detailed journal in which he describes a strange encounter with a terrifying man. Jansen writes, quote, "This will be my last visit to the Dark Continent. The people here have always been savage and unpredictable, the white men often worst of all. But until now, the promise of wealth has been enough. Today, there was a man, or at least what I at first took to be a man. He was tall, shirtless, and covered in dried blood. His face was mostly hidden beneath long, wild hair. The only black man at the port who did not have shackles on his feet. Usually, those that do come here, desperately looking for someone they lost, are afraid." Jansen describes this man as, quote, "desperate, yes, but not afraid." Jansen writes that the man walked up and down the dock, oblivious to the greedy glares of those who made a living peddling flesh like his. He ignored their guns, occasionally closing his eyes as if listening for something that only he could hear. I half expected them to take him, put shackles on his feet, and throw him on one of their ships. But something in the black eyes, the savage snarl of his mouth, and the animal blood and fur clinging to his hands kept them at bay. A single black man at the coast, surrounded by slave ships, is indeed a remarkable thing. But Jansen later has an even more strange encounter with this individual. Jansen writes that later that evening, as he was balancing his books below deck of his ship, he realized that the man had somehow made it into his room. Jansen details the encounter. Quote, "Then I was not alone. He was there with me. His skin blended with the darkness, but his eyes glowed like terrible fire from beneath his hair. He did not open his mouth to talk, but somehow I knew what he wanted. He was looking for a black girl, or rather, wanted to know where one had gone. It was an impossible question. Hundreds of bodies were put on ships every day. They all looked the same to me. Sweaty, black, and confused. Most of the women were naked, or soon would be." The details of how Kamau knew which ship took Asa and where she went can only be explained through the well-documented connection between a Obaifo and his lover. So Jansen, who had always profited from the slave trade, but had until then never directly sold anyone into slavery, records his only transaction of this kind. Black male, exact age unknown, but appears to be around 30, in good physical condition. Seemingly mute, but an excellent candidate for breeding or hard manual labor. Date of sale, July 7th, 1702. Sale price, £5. All reputable scholars agree that this is Kamau's passport to the New World, that the Obaifo would only have come here looking for her, that no slaver could have taken him unless he wanted to be taken. So it was that he, along with others, were packed into the hull of a ship ironically called the Bloody Princess. From there, Jansen is no longer any help to us. He will spend the rest of his life writing about the dangers of the blood drinkers in the New World, publishing articles claiming to have been forced to send one of these monsters to a small island in the Caribbean. He will die unknown and in poverty, and it will be many years before his writings are rediscovered and put in the proper context. We know that Kamau did not have these infamous locks when he first arrived on the island. And from what we know about the intake of men and women into slavery, we can again make certain assumptions. We can assume that Kamau was poked and prodded, stripped of all his clothes and examined like an animal. Then his head would have been shaved and he would have been thrown below with the other men, kept separate from the women by a heavy wall. The captain of the Bloody Princess was the Englishman James Hunt. He was a sloppy, hard-drinking, and awful man, but he kept meticulous notes. According to the captain's log, Hunt left with a full crew and 250 tons burthen, or 625 men and women. He never went below himself, but said that every day he would send, quote, some wretch to throw buckets of water on the cargo to wash away the piss, shit, and vomit that gathered everywhere, even though I let them up in shifts every day to stretch and relieve themselves. Hunt complains of one particularly troublesome piece of cargo on this voyage. They regularly refused to eat, but usually the whip or the speculum oris is enough to convince. Just a note here. A speculum oris is an abhorrent metal tool that could be used to force a person's mouth open if they refuse to eat. Hunt continues, quote, but one male is especially stubborn. The whip did not work. The black bastard barely bled or showed any pain. The speculum oris must be broken, because try as we might, there was no way to force his mouth open. This trip is quickly proving to be an ill-fated one. This was John Hunt's least favorite leg of the journey. He writes regularly that he preferred transporting cotton or sugar or the other goods that he got in England. None of those things screamed in the middle of the night or jumped overboard dragging other valuable cargo with them. None of those things made him uncomfortable by stalking the deck like a predator, even when circumstances suggested that they had to be the prey. Those things did not have to be watched constantly by the incompetent sailors who usually signed up because they had nowhere else to go. We can imagine Kamal below with the others, shackled to the ground, surrounded by filth, the dead and the dying, refusing to eat the rice and beans because an Abaifo would have found that dish especially repulsive. But there is actually record of this trip, found in the autobiography of Mamadou, the poet slave who would eventually escape to live with the runaways in the mountains. Mamadou describes the horrors of his journey to the so-called New World. The man to one side of me died. The one to the other side lived. I felt sorry for both of them. I felt sorry for all of us. I considered jumping overboard to meet my father and my mother, but I did not. Not because I was brave or afraid, but because I was ashamed. My father was a warrior who had killed a lion with a spear. My mother had died fighting off a pack of hyenas when they heard the cries of my baby brother. How could I meet them in the afterlife and tell them I let these chains and these blue-eyed men defeat me, so I kept living out of shame? The sad reality of that trip is well documented by many. But Mamadou also noticed an unusual prisoner with him in the hull. He writes extensively about one man, whose eyes sometimes glowed in the dark, and who did not seem to care for the sunlight on deck whenever they were dragged up for their daily exercise. Mamadou writes that he could not tell if it was the fever caused by the stench and death everywhere, or if the man in the darkness with them really was an Obaifo. If the man was a monster, then why did he not kill them and end the nightmare that even then Mamadou suspected was only beginning? After about a month at sea, with sores on his arms and legs, the sight of men and women being raped by red-faced sailors, his back wet from a dead man's piss, Mamadou writes that he called out in desperation to this stranger, who somehow sat upright in the darkest corner of the already dark hull of the ship. Mamadou relates this incident. I begged the Obaifo to kill me, drink my blood, take my energy, and then destroy these monsters for whom we did not yet have a name. But he did not. I saw the muscles under his beard tighten and relax. Then he placed his hand on a young boy who had suddenly burst into tears. I spat and swore until one of the sailors came over and hit me hard with the back of his hand. Looking back now, I understand why the Obaifo never fed on any of us, even though we would have been easy prey. While he was chained with us on the ship, he was not an Obaifo. He was not his name. We were all part of a single being, a thing that grew smaller whenever one of us died. No, one day he might kill us all when we got to where we were going, but he would never harm a single captive on that ship. Captain Hunt's log does relate that there were more missing sailors than usual on that journey. It is not uncommon for one or two sailors who usually came from the dregs of society, to fall overboard or die of disease. But on that trip, 15 of his sailors mysteriously disappeared. The Bloody Princess reached the island on October 1, 1702. Of the original 625 slaves, 38 were reported to have died during the voyage. One, however, a male, exact age unknown, but appeared to be around 30, in good physical condition, seemingly mute, and who had refused to eat, could not be located. John Hunt searched the ship thoroughly and interrogated his few remaining men, but they could not find the missing African. The captain's logs indicate that he assumed one of his men had failed to report the death. A reasonable assumption, since the missing prisoner had not eaten anything for 2 months as far as they could tell. So, he deducted the cost of the missing mail, £5, from their wages, and was happy to finally reach port. Mamadou's autobiography does not mention what happened to Kamau once the ship docked. There is a single passage about a firefly that flew around the dark hull of the ship, lighting every tired and frightened black face just as they reached the island. The firefly eventually left through a small window and disappeared into the blue, early morning, island light.